develop chemicals which might affect otherwise incurable tumors of the breast, the ovary, the uterus, the lung, the kidney, the intestine, and highly malignant tumors of the skin, such as the black cancer or melanoma, he wrote. The cure of even one such solid cancer in adults, Farber knew, would singularly revolutionize oncology. It would provide the most concrete proof that this was a winnable war. An anatomist's tumor. It took plain old courage to be a chemotherapist in the 1960s, and certainly the courage of the conviction that cancer would eventually succumb to drugs. Vincent DeVita, National Cancer Institute investigator, and eventually NCI director. On a chilly February morning in 2004, a 24-year-old athlete, Ben Orman, discovered a lump in his neck. He was in his apartment, reading the newspaper, when, running his hand absentmindedly past his face, his fingers brushed against a small swelling. The lump was about the size of a small dried grape. If he took a deep breath, he could swallow it back into the cavity of his chest. He dismissed it. It was a lump, he reasoned, and athletes were used to lumps. Calluses, swollen knees, boils, bumps, bruises, coming and going with no remembered cause. He returned to his newspaper, and worry vanished from his mind. The lump in his neck, whatever it was, would doubtless vanish in time as well. But it grew instead, imperceptibly at first, then more assertively, turning from grape size to prune size in about a month. He could feel it on the shallow dip of his collarbone. Worried, Orman went to the walk-in clinic of the hospital, almost apologetic about his complaints. The triage nurse scribbled in her notes, "lump in his neck," and added a question mark at the end of the sentence. With that sentence, Orman entered the unfamiliar world of oncology, swallowed, like his own lump, into the bizarre cavitary universe of cancer. The doors of the hospital opened and closed behind him. A doctor in a blue scrub suit stepped through the curtains and ran her hands up and down his neck. He had blood tests and x-rays in rapid succession, followed by CT scans and more examinations. The scans revealed that the lump in the neck was merely the tip of a much deeper iceberg of lumps. Beneath that sentinel mass, a chain of masses coiled from his neck down into his chest, culminating in a fist-sized tumor just behind his sternum. Large masses located in the anterior chest, as medical students learn, come in four T's, almost like a macabre nursery rhyme for cancer: thyroid cancer, thymoma, teratoma, and terrible lymphoma. Orman's problem, given his age and the matted, dense appearance of the lumps, was almost certainly the last of these, a lymphoma, cancer of the lymph glands. I saw Ben Orman nearly 2 months after that visit to the hospital. He was sitting in the waiting room, reading a book. He read fiercely, athletically, almost competitively, often finishing one novel a week as if in a race. In the 8 weeks since his ER visit, he had undergone a PET scan, a visit with a surgeon, and a biopsy of the neck lump. As suspected, the mass was a lymphoma, a relatively rare variant called Hodgkin's disease. More news followed. The scans revealed that Orman's cancer was confined entirely to one side of his upper torso, and he had none of the ghostly B symptoms, weight loss, fever, chills, or night sweats, that occasionally accompany Hodgkin's disease. In a staging system that ran from 1 to 4, with an A or B added to denote the absence or presence of the occult symptoms, he fell into stage 2A, relatively early in the progression of the disease. It was somber news, but of all the patients shuttling in and out of the waiting room that morning, Orman arguably carried the most benign prognosis. With an intensive course of chemotherapy, it was more than likely, 85% likely, that he would be cured. By intensive, I told him, I mean several months, perhaps even stretching out to half a year. The drugs will be given in cycles, and there will have to be visits in between to check blood counts. Every 3 weeks, just as his counts recovered, the whole cycle would begin all over again. Sisyphus on chemotherapy. He would lose his hair with the first cycle. He would almost certainly become permanently infertile. There might be life-threatening infections during the times when his white counts would bottom out nearly to zero. Most ominously, the chemo might cause a second cancer in the future. He nodded. I watched the thought pick up velocity in his brain until it had reached its full impact. "It's going to be a long haul, a marathon," I stammered apologetically, groping for an analogy. "But we'll get to the end." He nodded again silently, as if he already knew. On a Wednesday morning, not long after my meeting with Orman, I took a shuttle across Boston to see my patients at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Most of us called the institute simply the Farber. Large already in life, Sidney Farber had become even larger in death. The eponymous Farber was now a sprawling 16-story labyrinth of concrete, crammed full of scientists and physicians, a comprehensive lab, cum clinic, cum pharmacy, cum chemotherapy unit. There were 2,934 employees, dozens of conference rooms, scores of laboratories, a laundry unit, four banks of elevators, and multiple libraries. The site of the original basement lab had long been dwarfed by the massive complex of buildings around it. Like a vast, overbuilt and overwrought medieval temple, the Farber had long swallowed its shrine. As you entered the new building, an oil painting of the man himself, with his characteristic half-scowling, half-smiling face, stared back at you in the foyer. Little bits and pieces of him, it seemed, were strewn everywhere. The corridor on the way to the fellow's office was still hung with the cartoonish portraits that he had once commissioned for the Jimmy Fund, Snow White, Pinocchio, Jiminy Cricket, Dumbo. The bone marrow needles with which we performed our biopsies looked and felt as if they came from another age. Perhaps they had been sharpened by Farber or one of his trainees 50 years ago. Wandering through these labs and clinics, you often felt as if you could stumble onto cancer history at any minute. One morning, I did. Bolting to catch the elevator, I ran headlong into an old man in a wheelchair whom I first took to be a patient. It was Tom Fry, a professor emeritus now, heading up to his office on the 16th floor. My patient that Wednesday morning was a 76-year-old woman named Beatrice Sorensen. B, as she liked to be called, reminded me of one of those tiny insects or animals that you read about in natural history textbooks that can carry 10 times their weight or leap 5 times their height. She was almost preternaturally minuscule, about 85 pounds and 4.5 feet tall, with bird-like features and delicate bones that seemed to hang together like twigs in winter. To this diminutive frame, however, she brought a fierce force of personality, the lightness of body counterbalanced by the heftiness of soul. She had been a Marine and served in 2 wars. Even as I towered over her on the examination table, I felt awkward and humbled, as if she were towering over me in spirit. Sorensen had pancreatic cancer. The tumor had been discovered almost accidentally in the late summer of 2003, when she had had a bout of abdominal pain and diarrhea, and a CT scan had picked up a 4-centimeter solid nodule hanging off the tail of her pancreas. In retrospect, the diarrhea may have been unrelated. A brave surgeon had attempted to resect it, but the margins of the resection still contained some tumor cells. Even in oncology, a dismal discipline to begin with, this, unresected pancreatic cancer, was considered the epitome of the dismal. Sorensen's life had turned upside down. "I want to beat it to the end," she had told me at first. We had tried. Through the early fall, we blasted her pancreas with radiation to kill the tumor cells, then followed with chemotherapy, using the drug 5-fluorouracil. the tumor had grown right through all the treatments. In the winter, we had switched to a new drug called gemcitabine, or Gemzar. The tumor cells had shrugged the new drug off, instead mockingly sending a shower of painful metastases into her liver. At times, it felt as if we would have been better off with no drugs at all. Sorensen was at the clinic that morning to see if we could offer anything else. She wore white pants and a white shirt. Her paper-thin skin was marked with dry lines. She may have been crying, but her face was a cipher that I could not read. "She will try anything, anything," her husband pleaded. "She is stronger than she looks." But strong or not, there was nothing left to try. I stared down at my feet, unable to confront the obvious questions. The attending physician shifted uncomfortably in his chair. Beatrice finally broke the awkward silence. "I'm sorry." She shrugged her shoulders and looked vacantly past us. "I know we have reached an end." We hung our heads, ashamed. It was, I suspected, not the first time that a patient had consoled a doctor about the ineffectuality of his discipline. Two lumps seen on two different mornings. Two vastly different incarnations of cancer. One almost certainly curable. The second, an inevitable spiral into death. It felt, nearly 2,500 years after Hippocrates had naively coined the overarching term carcinos, that modern oncology was hardly any more sophisticated in its taxonomy of cancer. Orman's lymphoma and Sorensen's pancreatic cancer were both, of course, cancers, malignant proliferations of cells. But the diseases could not have been further apart in their trajectories and personalities. Even referring to them by the same name, cancer, felt like some sort of medical anachronism, like the medieval habit of using apoplexy to describe anything from a stroke to a hemorrhage to a seizure. Like Hippocrates, it was as if we too had naively lumped the lumps. But naive or not, it was this lumping, this emphatic, unshakable faith in the underlying singularity of cancer, more than its pluralities, that galvanized the Laskerites in the 1960s. Oncology was on a quest for cohesive truths, a universal cure, as Farber put it in 1962. And if the oncologists of the 1960s imagined a common cure for all forms of cancer, it was because they imagined a common disease called cancer. Curing one form, the belief ran, would inevitably lead to the cure of another, and so forth, like a chain reaction, until the whole malignant edifice had crumbled like a set of dominoes. That assumption, that a monolithic hammer would eventually demolish a monolithic disease, surcharged physicians, scientists, and cancer lobbyists with vitality and energy. For the Laskerites, it was an organizing principle, a matter of faith, the only certain beacon toward which they all gravitated. Indeed, the political consolidation of cancer that the Laskerites sought in Washington, a single institute, a single source of funds, led by a single physician or scientist, relied on a deeper notion of a medical consolidation of cancer into a single disease, a monolith, a single central narrative. Without this grand embracing narrative, neither Mary Lasker nor Sidney Farber could have envisioned a systematic, targeted war. The illness that had brought Ben Orman to the clinic late that evening, Hodgkin's lymphoma, was itself announced late to the world of cancer. Its discoverer, Thomas Hodgkin, was a thin, short, 19th-century English anatomist with a spade-like beard and an astonishingly curved nose, a character who might have walked out of an Edward Lear poem. Hodgkin was born in 1798 to a Quaker family in Pentonville, a small hamlet outside London. A precocious child, he grew quickly into an even more precocious young man, whose interests loped freely from geology to mathematics to chemistry. He apprenticed briefly as a geologist, then as an apothecary, and finally graduated from the University of Edinburgh with a degree in medicine. A chance event enticed Hodgkin into the world of pathological anatomy and led him toward the disease that would bear his name. In 1825, a struggle within the faculty of St. Thomas's and Guy's Hospital in London broke up the venerable institution into two bickering halves, Guy's Hospital and its new rival, St. Thomas's. This divorce, like many marital spats, was almost immediately followed by a vicious argument over the partition of property. The property here was a macabre ensemble, the precious anatomical collection of the hospital, brains, hearts, stomachs, and skeletons in pickling jars of formalin that had been hoarded for use as teaching tools for the hospital's medical students. St. Thomas's Hospital refused to part with its precious specimens, so Guy's scrambled to cobble together its own anatomical museum. Hodgkin had just returned from his second visit to Paris, where he had learned to prepare and dissect cadaveric specimens. He was promptly recruited to collect specimens for Guy's new museum. The job's most inventive academic perk, perhaps, was his new title, the curator of the museum and the inspector of the dead. Hodgkin proved to be an extraordinary inspector of the dead, a compulsive anatomical curator who hoarded hundreds of samples within a few years. But collecting specimens was a rather mundane task. Hodgkin's particular genius lay in organizing them. He became a librarian as much as a pathologist. He devised his own systematics for pathology. The original building that housed his collection has been destroyed. But the new museum, where Hodgkin's original specimens are still on display, is a strange marvel. A four-chambered atrium located deep inside a larger building, it is an enormous walk-in casket of wonders constructed of wrought iron and glass. You enter a door and ascend a staircase, then find yourself on the top floor of a series of galleries that cascade downward. Along every wall are rows of formalin-filled jars, lungs in one gallery, hearts in another, brains, kidneys, bones, and so forth. This method of organizing pathological anatomy, by organ system rather than by date or disease, was a revelation. By thus inhabiting the body conceptually, by climbing in and out of the body at will, often noting the correlation between organs and systems, Hodgkin found that he could recognize patterns within patterns instinctually, sometimes without even consciously registering them. In the early winter of 1832, Hodgkin announced that he had collected a series of cadavers, mostly of young men, who possessed a strange systemic disease. The illness was characterized, as he put it, by a peculiar enlargement of lymph glands. To the undiscerning eye, this enlargement could easily have been from tuberculosis or syphilis, the more common sources of glandular swelling at that time. But Hodgkin was convinced that he had encountered an entirely new disease, an unknown pathology unique to these young men. He wrote up the case of seven such cadavers and had his paper, On Some Morbid Appearances of the Absorbent Glands and Spleen, presented to the Medical and Chirurgical Society. The story of a compulsive young doctor putting old swellings into new pathological bottles was received without much enthusiasm. Only 8 members of the society reportedly attended the lecture. They filed out afterward in silence, not even bothering to record their names on the dusty attendance roster. Hodgkin, too, was a little embarrassed by his discovery. A pathological paper may perhaps be thought of a little value if unaccompanied by suggestions designed to assist in the treatment, either curative or palliative, he wrote. Merely describing an illness, without offering any therapeutic suggestions, seemed like an empty academic exercise to him, a form of intellectual frittering. Soon after publishing his paper, he began to drift away from medicine altogether. In 1837, after a rather vicious political spat with his superiors, he resigned his post at Guy's. He had a brief stint at St. Thomas's Hospital as its curator, a rebound affair that was doomed to fail. In 1844, he gave up his academic practice altogether. His anatomical studies slowly came to a halt. In 1898, some 30 years after Hodgkin's death, an Austrian pathologist, Karl Sternberg, was looking through a microscope at a patient's glands when he found a peculiar series of cells staring back at him, giant disorganized cells with cleaved bilobed nuclei, owl's eyes, as he described them, glaring sullenly out from the forests of lymph. Hodgkin's anatomy had reached its final cellular resolution. These owl's eye cells were malignant lymphocytes, lymph cells that had turned cancerous. Hodgkin's disease was a cancer of the lymph glands, a lymphoma. Hodgkin may have been disappointed by what he thought was only a descriptive study of his disease, but he had underestimated the value of careful observation. By compulsively studying anatomy alone, he had stumbled upon the most critical revelation about this form of lymphoma. Hodgkin's disease had a peculiar propensity of infiltrating lymph nodes locally, one by one. Other cancers could be more unpredictable, more capricious, as one oncologist put it. Lung cancer, for instance, might start as a spicular nodule in the lung, then unmoor itself and ambulate unexpectedly into the brain. Pancreatic cancer was notoriously known to send sprays of malignant cells into faraway sites such as the bones and the liver. But Hodgkin's, an anatomist's discovery, was anatomically deferential. It moved, as if with a measured, ordered pace, from one contiguous node to another, from gland to gland, and from region to region. It was this propensity to spread locally, from one node to the next, that poised Hodgkin's uniquely in the history of cancer. Hodgkin's disease was yet another hybrid among malignant diseases. If Farber's leukemia had occupied the hazy border between liquid and solid tumors, then Hodgkin's disease inhabited yet another strange borderland, a local disease on the verge of transforming into a systemic one. Halstead's vision of cancer on its way to becoming Galen's. In the early 1950s, at a cocktail party in California, Henry Kaplan, a professor of radiology at Stanford, overheard a conversation about the plan to build a linear accelerator for use by physicists at Stanford. A linear accelerator is an X-ray tube taken to an extreme form. Like a conventional X-ray tube, a linear accelerator also fires electrons onto a target to generate high-intensity X-rays. Unlike a conventional tube, however, the LINAC imbues massive amounts of energy into the electrons, pushing them to dizzying velocities before smashing them against the metal surface. The X-rays that emerge from this are deeply penetrating, powerful enough not only to pass through tissue, but to scald cells to death. Kaplan had trained at the NCI, where he had learned to use X-rays to treat leukemia in animals, but his interest had gradually shifted to solid tumors in humans, lung cancer, breast cancer, lymphomas. Solid tumors could be treated with radiation, he knew, but the outer shell of the cancer, like its eponymous crab's carapace, needed to be penetrated deeply to kill cancer cells. A linear accelerator, with its sharp, dense, knife-like beam, might allow him to reach tumor cells buried deep inside tissues. In 1953, he persuaded a team of physicists and engineers at Stanford to tailor-make an accelerator exclusively for the hospital. The accelerator was installed in a vault-like warehouse in San Francisco in 1956. Dodging traffic between Fillmore Street and Mission Hill, Kaplan personally wheeled in its colossal block of lead shielding on an automobile jack borrowed from a neighboring garage owner. Through a minuscule pinhole in that lead block, he could now direct tiny, controlled doses of a furiously potent beam of X-rays, millions of electron volts of energy in concentrated bursts, to lancinate any cancer cell to death. But what form of cancer? If Kaplan had learned one lesson at the NCI, it was that by focusing microscopically on a single disease, one could extrapolate into the entire universe of diseases. The characteristics that Kaplan sought in his target were relatively well-defined. Since the LINAC could only focus its killer beam on local sites, it would have to be a local, not a systemic, cancer. Leukemia was out of the question. Breast and lung cancer were important targets, but both were unpredictable, mercurial diseases, with propensities for occult and systemic spread. The powerful oculus of Kaplan's intellect, swiveling about through the malignant world, ultimately landed on the most natural target for his investigation, Hodgkin's disease. Henry Kaplan was Hodgkin's disease, George Kanellis, a former senior clinician at the NCI, told me, leaning back in his chair. We were sitting in his office while he rummaged through piles of manuscripts, monographs, articles, books, catalogs, and papers, pulling out occasional pictures of Kaplan from his files. Here was Kaplan dressed in a bow tie, looking at sheaves of papers at the NCI, or Kaplan in a white coat, standing next to the LINAC at Stanford, its 5-million-volt probe just inches from his nose. Kaplan wasn't the first doctor to treat Hodgkin's with X-rays, but he was certainly the most dogged, the most methodical, and the most single-minded. In the mid-1930s, a Swiss radiologist named René Gilbert had shown that the swollen lymph nodes of Hodgkin's disease could effectively and dramatically be reduced with radiation. But Gilbert's patients had typically relapsed after treatment, often in the lymph nodes immediately contiguous to the original radiated area. At the Toronto General Hospital, a Canadian surgeon named Vera Peters had furthered Gilbert's studies by broadening the radiation field even farther, delivering X-rays not to a single swollen node, but to an entire area of lymph nodes. Peters called her strategy extended field radiation. In 1958, analyzing the cohort of patients that she had treated, Peters observed that broad-field radiation could significantly improve long-term survival for early-stage Hodgkin's patients. But Peters' data was retrospective, based on the historical analysis of prior-treated patients. What Peters needed was a more rigorous medical experiment, a randomized clinical trial. Historical series can be biased by doctors' highly selective choices of patients for therapy, or by their counting only the ones that do the best. Independently of Peters, Kaplan had also realized that extended field radiation could improve relapse-free survival, perhaps even cure early-stage Hodgkin's disease. But he lacked formal proof. In 1962, challenged by one of his students, Henry Kaplan set out to prove the point. The trials that Kaplan designed still rank among the classics of study design. In the first set, called the L1 trials, he assigned equal numbers of patients to either extended field radiation or to limited involved field radiation, and plotted relapse-free survival cures. The answer was definitive. Extended field radiation, meticulous radiotherapy, as one doctor described it, drastically diminished the relapse rate of Hodgkin's disease. But Kaplan knew that a diminished relapse rate was not a cure, so he delved further. 2 years later, the Stanford team carved out a larger field of radiation, involving nodes around the aorta, the large arch-shaped blood vessel that leads out of the heart. Here they introduced an innovation that would prove pivotal to their success. Kaplan knew that only patients that had localized Hodgkin's disease could possibly benefit from radiation therapy. To truly test the efficacy of radiation therapy, then, Kaplan realized that he would need a strictly limited cohort of patients whose Hodgkin's disease involved just a few contiguous lymph nodes. To exclude patients with more disseminated forms of lymphoma, Kaplan devised an intense battery of tests to stage his patients. There were blood tests, a detailed clinical exam, a procedure called lymphangiography, a primitive ancestor of a CT scan for the lymph nodes, and a bone marrow biopsy. Even so, Kaplan was unsatisfied. Doubly careful, he began to perform exploratory abdominal surgery and biopsy internal nodes to ensure that only patients with locally confined disease were entering his trials. The doses of radiation were now daringly high. But gratifyingly, the responses soared as well. Kaplan documented even greater relapse-free intervals, now stretching out into dozens of months, then years. When the first batch of patients had survived 5 years without relapses, he began to speculate that some may have been cured by extended field X-rays. Kaplan's experimental idea had finally made its way out of a San Francisco warehouse into the mainstream clinical world. But hadn't Halstead wagered on the same horse and lost? Hadn't radical surgery become entangled in the same logic, carving out larger and larger areas for treatment, and then spiraled downward? Why did Kaplan succeed where others had failed? First, because Kaplan meticulously restricted radiotherapy to patients with early-stage disease. He went to exhaustive lengths to stage patients before unleashing radiation on them. By strictly narrowing the group of patients treated, Kaplan markedly increased the likelihood of his success. And second, he succeeded because he had picked the right disease. Hodgkin's was, for the most part, a regional illness. Fundamental to all attempts at curative treatment of Hodgkin's disease, one reviewer commented memorably in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1968, is the assumption that in the significant fraction of cases, the disease is localized. Kaplan treated the intrinsic biology of Hodgkin's disease with utmost seriousness. If Hodgkin's lymphoma had been more capricious in its movement through the body, and occult areas of spread more common, as in some forms of breast cancer, then Kaplan's staging strategy, for all his excruciatingly detailed workups, would inherently have been doomed to fail. Instead of trying to tailor the disease to fit his medicine, Kaplan learned to tailor his medicine to fit the right disease. This simple principle, the meticulous matching of a particular therapy to a particular form and stage of cancer, would eventually be given its due merit in cancer therapy. Early stage local cancers, Kaplan realized, were often inherently different from widely spread metastatic cancers, even within the same form of cancer. 100 instances of Hodgkin's disease, even though pathologically classified as the same entity, were 100 variants around a common theme. Cancers possessed temperaments, personalities, behaviors. And biological heterogeneity demanded therapeutic heterogeneity. The same treatment could not indiscriminately be applied to all. But even if Kaplan understood it fully in 1963 and made an example of it in treating Hodgkin's disease, it would take decades for a generation of oncologists to come to the same realization. An Army on the March. Now we are an army on the march. Sidney Farber, in 1963. The next step, the complete cure, is almost sure to follow. Kenneth Endicott, NCI Director, 1963. The role of aggressive multiple drug therapy in the quest for long-term survival in cancer is far from clear. R. Stein, a scientist in 1969. One afternoon in the late summer of 1963, George Kanellis, then a senior fellow at the NCI, walked into the clinical center to find Tom Fry scribbling furiously on one of the institute's blackboards. Fry, in his long white coat, was making lists of chemicals and drawing arrows. On one side of the board was a list of cytotoxic drugs, Cytoxan, Vincristine, Procarbazine, Methotrexate. On the other side was a list of new cancers that Zubrod and Fry wanted to target. Breast, ovarian, lung cancers, lymphomas. Connecting the two halves of the blackboard were chalky lines matching combinations of cytotoxic drugs to cancers. For a moment, it almost looked as if Fry had been deriving mathematical equations. A plus B kills C. E plus F eliminates G. The drugs on Fry's list came largely from three sources. Some, such as aminopterin or methotrexate, were the products of inspired guesswork by scientists. Farber had discovered aminopterin by guessing that an antifolate might block the growth of leukemia cells. Others, such as nitrogen mustard or actinomycin D, came from serendipitous sources, such as mustard gas or soil bacteria, found accidentally to kill cancer cells. Yet others, such as 6-MP, came from drug screening efforts in which thousands of molecules were tested to find the handful that possessed cancer-killing activity. The notable common feature that linked all these drugs was that they were all rather indiscriminate inhibitors of cellular growth. Nitrogen mustard, for instance, damages DNA and kills nearly all dividing cells. It kills cancer cells somewhat preferentially because cancer cells divide most actively. To design an ideal anti-cancer drug, one would need to identify a specific molecular target in a cancer cell and create a chemical to attack that target. But the fundamental biology of cancer was so poorly understood that defining such molecular targets was virtually inconceivable in the 1960s. Yet even lacking such targets, Fry and Freireich had cured leukemia in some children. Even generic cellular poisons, dosed with adequate brio, could thus eventually obliterate cancer. The bravado of that logic was certainly hypnotic. Vincent DeVita, another fellow at the Institute during that time, wrote, "A new breed of cancer investigators in the 1960s had been addressing the generic question of whether or not cytotoxic chemotherapy was ever capable of curing patients with any type of advanced malignancies. For Fry and Zubrod, the only way to answer that generic question was to direct the growing armamentarium of combination chemotherapy against another cancer, a solid tumor this time, which would retrace their steps with leukemia. If yet another kind of cancer responded to this strategy, then there could be little doubt that oncology had stumbled upon a generic solution to the generic problem. A cure would then be within reach for all cancers." But which cancer would be used to test the principle? Like Kaplan, Zubrod, DeVita, and Canellis also focused on Hodgkin's disease, a cancer that lived on the ill-defined cusp between solid and liquid, a stepping stone between leukemia and, say, lung cancer or breast cancer. At Stanford, Kaplan had already demonstrated that Hodgkin's lymphoma could be staged with exquisite precision, and that local disease could be cured with high-dose extended-field radiation. Kaplan had solved half the equation. He had used local therapy with radiation to cure localized forms of Hodgkin's disease. If metastatic Hodgkin's disease could be cured by systemic and aggressive combination chemotherapy, then Zubrod's generic solution would begin to sound plausible. The equation would be fully solved. Outspoken, pugnacious, and bold, a child of the rough-and-tumble Yonkers area of New York who had bulldozed his way through college and medical school, Vincent DeVita had come to the NCI in 1963 and fallen into the intoxicating orbit of Zubrod, Fry, and Freireich. The unorthodoxy of their approach, the maniacs doing cancer research, as he called it, had instantly fascinated him. These were the daredevils of medical research, acrobats devising new drugs that nearly killed patients. These men played chicken with death. Somebody had to show the skeptics that you could actually cure cancer with the right drugs, he believed. In the early months of 1964, he set out to prove the skeptics wrong. The first test of intensive combination chemotherapy for advanced-stage Hodgkin's disease, led by DeVita, combined four drugs: methotrexate, vincristine, also called Oncovin, nitrogen mustard, and prednisone, a highly toxic cocktail called mump. Only 14 patients were treated. All suffered the predictable consequences of combination chemotherapy. All were hospitalized and confined in isolation chambers to prevent infections during the life-threatening drop in blood counts. As expected, the regimen was sharply criticized at the NCI. This, again, was a quantum leap into a deadly world of mixed poisons. But Fry intervened, silencing the critics and allowing the program to continue. In 1964, DaVita modified the regimen further. Methotrexate was substituted with a more powerful agent, procarbazine, and the duration of treatment was lengthened from 2.5 months to 6 months. With a team of young, like-minded fellows at the NCI, DaVita began to enroll patients with advanced Hodgkin's disease in a trial of this new cocktail, called MOP. Like lymphoblastic leukemia, Hodgkin's disease is a rare illness, but the researchers did not need to look hard to find patients. Advanced Hodgkin's disease, often accompanied by the spectral B symptoms, was uniformly fatal. Young men and women, the disease typically strikes men and women in their 20s and 30s, were often referred to the NCI as hopeless cases, and therefore ideal experimental subjects. In just 3 years, DaVita and Canellis thus accumulated cases at a furious clip, 43 patients in all. 9 had been blasted with increasing fields of radiation, a la Kaplan, and still progressed inexorably to disseminated, widely metastatic disease. Others had been treated with an ad hoc mix of single agents. None had shown any durable response to prior drugs. So, like the younger band of leukemics that had gone before them, a fresh new cohort appeared at the Institute every 2 weeks, occupying the plastic chairs of the clinical center, lining up for the government-issued cookies and awaiting the terrifying onslaught of the experimental drugs. The youngest was 12, not even a teenager yet, with lymphoma cells packed in her lungs and liver. A 13-year-old boy had Hodgkin's in his pleural cavity. Malignant fluid had compressed itself into the lining between his chest wall and lung and made it hard to breathe. The oldest was a 69-year-old woman, with Hodgkin's disease choking off the entrance to her intestine. If the terror of VAMP was death by infection, children slumped on ventilators with no white blood cells to speak of and bacteria streaming in their blood, then the terror of MOP was more visceral, death by nausea. The nausea that accompanied the therapy was devastating. It appeared suddenly, then abated just as suddenly, almost capable of snapping the mind shut with its intensity. Many of the patients on the protocol were flown in from nearby cities every fortnight. The trip back home, with the drugs lurching in the blood and the plane lurching in the air, was, for many, a nightmare even worse than their disease. The nausea was merely a harbinger. As DaVita charged ahead with combination chemotherapy, more complex and novel devastations were revealed. Chemotherapy caused permanent sterility in men and some women. The annihilation of the immune system by the cytotoxic drugs allowed peculiar infections to sprout up. The first adult case of a rare form of pneumonia caused by an organism, Pneumocystis carinii, PCP, was observed in a patient receiving MOP. The same pneumonia, arising spontaneously in immune-compromised gay men in 1981, would augur the arrival of the HIV epidemic in America. Perhaps the most disturbing side effect of chemotherapy would emerge nearly a decade later. Several young men and women, cured of Hodgkin's disease, would relapse with a second cancer, typically an aggressive, drug-resistant leukemia, caused by the prior treatment with MOP chemotherapy. As with radiation, cytotoxic chemotherapy would thus turn out to be a double-edged sword, cancer-curing on one hand and cancer-causing on the other. But the evidently grim litany of side effects notwithstanding, even early in the course of treatment, there was payoff. In many of the young men and women, the palpable, swollen lymph nodes dissolved in weeks. A 12-year-old boy from Illinois had been so ravaged by Hodgkin's that his weight had sunk to 50 pounds. Within 3 months of treatment, he gained nearly half his body weight and shot up 2 feet in height. In others, the stranglehold of Hodgkin's disease loosened on the organs. Pleural effusions gradually cleared, and the nodes in the gut disappeared. As the months passed, it was clear that combination chemo had struck gold once again. At the end of half a year, 35 of the 43 patients had achieved a complete remission. The MOP trial did not have a control group, but one was not needed to discern the effect. The response and remission rate were unprecedented for advanced Hodgkin's disease. The success would continue in the long term. More than half the initial cohort of patients would be cured. Even Kaplan, not an early believer in chemotherapy, was astonished. "Some of the patients with advanced disease have now survived relapse-free," he wrote. "The advent of multiple drug chemotherapy has dramatically changed the prognosis of patients with previously untreated stage 3 or stage 4 Hodgkin's disease." In May 1968, as the MOP trial was ascending to its unexpected crescendo, there was equally unexpected news in the world of lymphoblastic leukemia. Fry and Freireich's VAMP regimen had trailed off at a strange and bleak point. Combination chemo had cured most of the children of leukemia in their blood and bone marrow, but the cancer had explosively relapsed in the brain. In the months following VAMP in 1962, most of these children had hobbled back to the clinic with seemingly innocuous neurological complaints and then spiraled furiously toward their deaths just a week or two afterward. VAMP, once widely touted as the Institute's success story, had turned instead into its progressive nightmare. Of the 15 patients treated on the initial protocol, only 2 still survived. At the NCI, the ambition and bravado that had spurred the original studies was rapidly tipping toward a colder reality. Perhaps Farber's critics had been right. Perhaps lymphoblastic leukemia was a disease that could, at best, be sent into a flickering remission, but never cured. Perhaps palliative care was the best option after all. But having tasted the success of high-dose chemotherapy, many oncologists could not scale back their optimism. What if even VAMP had not been intensive enough? What if a chemotherapy regimen could be muscled up further, pushed closer to the brink of tolerability? The leader of this gladiatorial camp was a protege of Farber's, a 36-year-old oncologist, Donald Pinkel, who had been recruited from Boston to start a leukemia program in Memphis, Tennessee. Although trained in Boston under Farber, Pinkel had spent several years at the Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York, before moving to Memphis in 1961. In many ways, Memphis was the antipode of Boston. Convulsing with bitter racial tensions and rock and roll music, gyrating between the gold and pink of the Graceland Mansion in its south and the starkly segregated black neighborhoods in its north, Memphis was turbulent, unpredictable, colorful, perennially warm, and, medically speaking, virtually a no-man's land. Pinkel's new hospital, called St. Jude's, named, aptly enough, after the patron saint of lost causes, rose like a marooned concrete starfish out of a concrete parking lot on a barren field. In 1961, when Pinkel arrived, the hospital was barely functional, with no track record, uncertain finances, an unfinished building, no employees or faculty. Still, Pinkel got a chemotherapy ward up and running, with nurses, residents, and fellows trained in administering the toxic mercurial drugs, and flung far from the epicenters of leukemia research in New York and Boston, Pinkel's team was determined to outdo every other leukemia trial, the edge outmoding the center, to push the logic of high-dose combination chemotherapy to its extreme. Pinkel thus hammered away in trial after trial, edging his way toward the outer limit of tolerability, and Pinkel and his collaborators emerged with four crucial innovations to the prior regimens. The Roswell Park Group, led by James Holland and Joseph Birchinell at the Memorial Hospital in New York, continued to collaborate with Pinkel in developing the leukemia protocols. First, Pinkel reasoned that while combinations of drugs were necessary to induce remissions, combinations were insufficient in themselves. Perhaps one needed combinations of combinations, 6, 7, or even 8 different chemical poisons mixed and matched together for maximum effect. Second, since the nervous system relapses had likely occurred because even these highly potent chemicals could not breach the blood-brain barrier, perhaps one needed to instill chemotherapy directly into the nervous system by injecting it into the fluid that bathes the spinal cord. Third, perhaps even that instillation was not enough. Since X-rays could penetrate the brain regardless of the blood-brain barrier, perhaps one needed to add high-dose radiation to the skull to kill residual cells in the brain. And finally, as Minshew Lee had seen with choriocarcinoma, perhaps one needed to continue chemotherapy not just for weeks and months, as Fry and Freireich had done, but for month after month, stretching into 2 or even 3 years. The treatment protocol that emerged from these guiding principles could only be described as one of Pinkel's colleagues called it, an all-out combat. To start with, the standard anti-leukemic drugs were given in rapid-fire succession. Then, at defined intervals, methotrexate was injected into the spinal canal using a spinal tap. The brain was irradiated with high doses of X-rays. Then chemotherapy was bolstered even further with higher doses of drugs and alternating intervals in maximum tolerated doses. Antibiotics and transfusions were usually needed, often in succession, often for weeks on end. The treatment lasted up to 2.5 years. It involved multiple exposures to radiation, scores of blood tests, dozens of spinal taps, and multiple intravenous drugs, a strategy so precise and demanding that one journal refused to publish it, concerned that it was impossible to even dose it and monitor it correctly without killing several patients in the trials. Even at St. Jude's, the regimen was considered so overwhelmingly toxic that the trial was assigned to relatively junior physicians under Pinkel's supervision because the senior researchers, knowing its risks, did not want to run it. Pinkel called it total therapy. As fellows, we called it total hell. Carla Reed entered this form of hell in the summer of 2004. Chemotherapy and radiation came back to back, one dark tide after another. Some days she got home in the evening, her children already in bed, her husband waiting with dinner, only to turn around and come back the next morning. She lost sleep, her hair, and her appetite, and then something more important and ineffable, her animus, her drive, her will. She walked around the hospital like a zombie, shuffling in small steps from the blue vinyl couch in the infusion room to the water dispenser in the central corridor, then back to the couch in those evenly measured steps. The radiation treatment was the last straw, she recalled. Lying on the treatment table as still as death, with the mask on my face, I often wondered whether I would even wake up. Even her mother, who had flown in and out of Boston regularly during Carla's first month of treatment, retreated to her own house in Florida, red-eyed and exhausted. Carla withdrew even more deeply into her own world. Her melancholy hardened into something impenetrable, a carapace, and she pulled into it instinctually, shutting everything out. She lost her friends. During her first few visits, I noticed that she often brought a cheerful young woman as a companion. One morning, I noticed that the friend was missing. "No company today?" I asked. Carla looked away and shrugged her shoulders. We had a falling out. There was something steely, mechanical in her voice. She needed to be needed, and I just couldn't fulfill that demand. Not now. I found myself, embarrassingly enough, sympathizing with the missing friend. As Carla's doctor, I needed to be needed as well, to be acknowledged, even as a peripheral participant in her battle. But Carla had barely any emotional energy for her own recuperation, and certainly none to spare for the needs of others. For her, the struggle with leukemia had become so deeply personalized, so interiorized, that the rest of us were ghostly onlookers in the periphery. We were the zombies walking outside her head. Her clinic visits began and ended with awkward pauses. Walking across the hospital in the morning to draw yet another bone marrow biopsy, with the wintry light cross-hatching the rooms, I felt a certain dread descend on me, a heaviness that bordered on sympathy, but never quite achieved it. Test came after test. 7 months into her course, Carla had now visited the clinic 66 times, had had 58 blood tests, 7 spinal taps, and several bone marrow biopsies. One writer, a former nurse, described the typical course of total therapy in terms of the tests involved. From the time of his diagnosis, Eric's illness had lasted 628 days. He had spent one quarter of these days either in a hospital bed or visiting the doctors. He had received more than 800 blood tests, numerous spinal and bone marrow taps, 30 x-rays, 120 biochemical tests, and more than 200 transfusions. No fewer than 20 doctors, hematologists, pulmonologists, neurologists, surgeons, specialists, and so on, were involved in his treatment, not including the psychologist and a dozen nurses. How Pinkel and his team convinced 4- and 6-year-olds in Memphis to complete that typical routine remains a mystery in its own right. But he did. In July 1968, the St. Jude's team published its preliminary data on the results of the most advanced iteration of total therapy. Pinkel's team would run 8 consecutive trials between 1968 and 1979, each adding another modification to the regimen. This particular trial, an early variant, was non-randomized and small, a single hospital's experience with a single cohort of patients. But despite all the caveats, the result was electrifying. The Memphis team had treated 31 patients in all. 27 of them had attained a full remission. The median time to relapse, the time between diagnosis and relapse, a measure of the efficacy of treatment, had stretched out to nearly 5 years. More than 20 times the longest remissions achieved by most of Farber's first patients. But most important, 13 patients, about a third of the original cohort, had never relapsed. They were still alive, off chemotherapy. The children had come back to the clinic month after month. The longest remission was now in its 6th year, half the lifetime of that child. In 1979, Pinkel's team revisited the entire cohort of patients treated over several years with total therapy. Overall, 278 patients in 8 consecutive trials had completed their courses of medicines and stopped chemotherapy. Of those, about 1/5 had relapsed. The rest, 80%, remained disease-free after chemotherapy, cured, as far as anyone could tell. ALL in children cannot be considered an incurable disease, Pinkel wrote in a review article. Palliation is no longer an acceptable approach to its initial treatment. He was writing to the future, of course, but in a more mystical sense, he was writing back to the past, to the doctors who had been deeply nihilistic about therapy for leukemia and had once argued with Farber to let his children quietly die in peace. The Cart and the Horse. I am not opposed to optimism,